This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. In sports, it's usually the one who scores who gets the most glory. The quarterback who threw the Hail Mary, the baller who sank the buzzer beater, the slugger who hit the grand slam. But sports statisticians track assists, too. The block, the rebound, the RBI. Those stats are often less flashy, but they're just as important. Today on Only a Game, we're going to bring you stories of sports assists, though they're not the kind that will appear on any stat line. We're going to start with a story about two women. They're not professional athletes. They're not famous. They're just two friends, Caroline Steer and Vanessa Oshima, who back in the 1980s went to high school together in a small town in New Zealand.
It's called Metameta, so M-A-T-A, M-A-T-A.
That's Vanessa. She says when she and Caroline were in school together, they were both into sports. But Caroline remembers things a bit differently.
I was incredibly unfit. I was notorious for hiding from cross country, and I would have told you back then that I can't run. It's just an impossibility.
After high school, Caroline and Vanessa went to different universities. Vanessa moved to Japan. Caroline stayed in New Zealand. The two fell out of touch, as friends living apart sometimes do. 15, maybe 20 years went by before they found a reason to connect again.
It started with Caroline. She'd seen on Facebook that I had had a great day running, and she sent a message saying I was having a bit of a crappy day, but now I feel inspired to actually go out and try something. So I messaged back and said, well, hey, what's going on? And she said, well, I've just been diagnosed with cancer.
It was breast cancer.
The first chemo session kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. So I was thinking about diet and exercise and what can I do to make the whole chemo process easier. Just seeing her running was like, that's so awesome. Maybe that's, you know, like that's part of the puzzle.
I said, well, hold on, that's easy. If what, me running makes you want to go fight this? I'll run, and I'll run until you're done.
Vanessa promised to run every single day for Caroline, and jogging down to the end of the block and back wouldn't count. She'd run at least 5K, that's 3.1 miles, and she'd do it outdoors because running on a treadmill was just too easy.
People who are fighting cancer don't get to choose that. They don't get to say, oh, you know what, today I think I'll just treadmill it.
Vanessa's husband, Yasu, was a cancer survivor, so she knew she'd be at it for a while, maybe 2 or 3 years. Caroline says right from the beginning, it made her feel better to know that Vanessa was going to all this trouble for her, and she made her own promise.
To start off for me, it was 20 minutes every day of, for example, walking up and down my road. But over time, I actually started to run. Although my husband did describe my running at first as an animated wobble, but it was my animated wobble.
While Caroline was perfecting her wobble, Vanessa ran every day for 50 days, then 100. She'd post updates on Facebook using the hashtag OutRunCancer.
She was a big part of what got me through my dark time, my treatment and the tough time. She gave me something that really made me smile. You know, like I looked forward to her posts. What's Vanessa doing today? What's the next installment?
Soon, Vanessa started recruiting friends who wanted to outrun cancer too. They'd each commit to running every day for 50 days. And even though they'd never met Caroline, they all ran for her.
I remember one day, I think it was day 200, and we decided to do a run all together, and we ran in the park, and it was cherry blossom season, and we Skyped her because she was still in the middle of chemotherapy, and she cried on the Skype call, and she just, it's just amazing to know that people I don't know are doing this for me. I think that was when it started to hit us that we were doing something special.
Caroline finished chemotherapy and began hormone treatment on day 259. Vanessa kept running. She ran through injury, she ran through a typhoon. A year went by, then two, then three. Along the way, Vanessa raised $16,000 to fight cancer. After a while, even though she was healthy, Caroline wasn't able to keep up her daily runs or wobbles. Work and life got in the way. But on day 1000, she flew to Tokyo and she and Vanessa ran together.
And I'd always said to her, look, anything I can do ever, I'm here for you. And of course, if the same was to happen to you, I would run every day for you. To be honest, I always thought, no, Vanessa's so healthy, she'd never get anything like this.
But after more than 4 years of running every day to outrun cancer, Vanessa started to feel like something wasn't quite right. At first, she thought maybe she'd just pulled a muscle. But when the feeling didn't go away, she decided to go in for her yearly mammogram a little early.
The doctor immediately, as soon as she saw the mammogram, she said, this is not good. And I was like, what? What do you mean, not good? And she goes, we need to do a biopsy on this one.
So by the time the biopsy came back, were you ready for bad news?
Oh, God, no, I was ready for good news. The doctor came back and she was so blunt, bless her soul. She goes, okay, so you have cancer. And I was like, oh.
Later that night, Vanessa called Caroline.
At about 11:20 at night, and we chatted, and you know, I tried to be as supporting as I could. And then I got my nightlight on my phone, and I went for my first run that night. It felt like the beginning for me all over. Just it took you back to, I know where she's at, I know what she's going through, and you know, I need to support her as well as she supported me.
At first, Vanessa says she tried to hide her pain from Caroline. Before long, she realized she didn't need to. When Vanessa had questions about what would happen next, she called Caroline. When she felt like she was going crazy, she called Caroline. Still, 2 days before she was scheduled for surgery, it all got to be too much. She was running in the park with her husband, and she started crying. She couldn't stop.
And he said, what's wrong? And I said, you know what? For 4 years, I've been using this hashtag, outrun cancer, and you can't outrun it. It catches you. It caught me. It caught Caroline. It caught you. I mean, so what's the point? It doesn't matter how we do this. I can raise all the money I want. I can't do it.
It was the closest Vanessa had come to quitting. But her husband, Yasu, encouraged her to try to keep going for just one more day. And soon, she wouldn't have a choice. Vanessa and her doctor decided on a radical mastectomy and lymph node removal. They hoped that with this surgery, Vanessa would be able to avoid chemotherapy. But her doctor said it would likely end the streak.
I think it would have been one thing if I'd, like, broken a bone or an injury, and it's like, okay, I'm stopping for injury. But the pain of the streak that was all about beating cancer is stopped by cancer. Just, it didn't sit well with me. But I needed to come to terms with that, and I kind of did. So I was almost at peace with ending it.
Vanessa went for a run at 4:30 on the morning of her surgery. When surgery was over, she sent her running shoes home with her husband. At 10 the next morning, Vanessa's doctor came in to check on her.
And she's like, well, you know what? You could be okay to do a slow jog indoors. You're not going outdoors. Be close to where the nurses are. Don't break a sweat. Don't use your arms. You'll be okay.
Vanessa immediately texted Yasu and asked him to bring her running shoes back. But for the rest of the day, she couldn't bring herself to put them on.
Cancer, for me at least, it shakes your confidence. You know, that you think you're this healthy person and then suddenly you're not. At 8:30, I thought, you know what, let's try. And so I put on my sneakers and I ran 42 laps in front of the elevator bay. Backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. There were tears. I don't know if there were tears of sadness or elation or just tiredness, but there were tears and questions. Why am I doing this? Is this the right way to tackle this? Doubt. Yeah, so it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was a good run, but it was, I don't know, a small victory to say, you know what, cancer, you didn't stop me. Try again. April 1st, 2017. I have 1,663 days of running 5 kilometers per day.
Like with so many of her runs, Vanessa posted an update on Facebook. It ended with this.
One day I will not run. Today was not that day. Hashtag outrun cancer. There's so much energy you have. You can use energy to find an excuse not to do something. I could give you 10 million excuses why I'm not going to run. You know, I'm got a busy day today. It's raining. I've got cancer. But yeah, I could give you 10 excuses to not run. All you need is one to do something. And I think Caroline became that one reason for me.
And Caroline, well, she couldn't keep her running streak going when she was only running for herself. But now that she's running for Vanessa.
I have run every day without exception. I'm still not a runner. There's no grace. There's no speed. I do my run each night and I come back feeling better for it.
She always used to say to me that it was really great having me run for her. And I thought that she was being nice, quote unquote. But now that I'm going through it, I get it. I wake up in the morning and I see on Facebook, hey, day 99, da-da-da, outrun cancer. And I get it.
Vanessa recovered from surgery without missing a day of running. She'll be on hormone therapy for the next 5 years. And she says she'll keep running until the day she comes back from a run and says to herself, it's not helping anymore. As for Caroline?
Well, her commitment to me was until I'd finished my treatment. And my commitment to her is the same, I guess. But, you know what? I'm kind of enjoying the run for the run's sake. So, I don't know. Part of me thinks, as long as you can run, run.
When this story first aired in June of 2016, Caroline Steer had run for 115 days in a row, Vanessa Oshima for 1,739. Since then, Caroline and Vanessa have continued to organize flash mobs and fundraisers to support people fighting the disease. And they've both continued to run. Caroline Steer has outrun cancer more than 500 days in a row. Vanessa Oshima's streak stands at more than 2,000 days. There will be a day when they do not run, but today is not that day. Former NFL tight end Conrad Ruhlin died almost 2 years ago at the age of 29. Soon afterward, a baseball Hall of Famer received an organ transplant.
And so I called the donor company and I said, hey, listen, you know, it's all over the internet, it's everywhere. I said, I need to know, did my son's heart and left kidney go to Rod Carew?
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This message comes from Only a Game sponsor, Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager. Full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
I'm Karen Given. Today's show is about assists, and there are two of them in this next story. One comes early, when a young boy meets a Hall of Famer who inspires him. You've heard stories like that one before. The second assist comes nearly two decades later, when that boy, now a pro athlete himself, gives a much more significant assist to the Hall of Famer. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Conrad Ruhlin had what people in sports call a motor.
I had to put bells on his shoes.
That's Mary Ruhlin, Conrad's mother.
I needed to know where that little guy was at all times because he just had so much energy. And if I took him grocery shopping, I had to actually harness him in the cart. One time he got out of the cart and I could not find him. And he was hiding in a freezer case. So I had to be on my game with this one, I'll tell you that.
Conrad was on his game, too. By age 4, he was pouring his considerable energy into baseball, basketball, soccer, and tennis. When he was 11, he crossed paths with a baseball legend.
He happened to meet Rod Carew at grade school.
Rod Carew, the 1967 Rookie of the Year and All-Star for 18 consecutive seasons. Rod Carew, the 1977 American League MVP and winner of 7 batting titles. When they met, Carew was Conrad's favorite professional athlete in any sport.
And I remember him getting into the car when I went to pick him up, and he says, "Mommy, Mom, I met Rod Carew today, and you know, he was a pro athlete, and you know, I want to be a pro athlete." And the whole rest of the day just resonated with him talking about his meeting Rod Carew, and that sure left an impression on young Conrad.
Conrad played baseball for a time, but focused on basketball and football in high school. He was one of the top tight ends in the country. He played 2 years at Notre Dame and 2 years at Stanford. He was undrafted coming out of college in 2011, but in 2012, he played in 16 regular season games and hauled in 11 passes with the New York Jets. His pro career looked like it was taking off.
It was tremendous.
That's Rolf Ruhland, Conrad's dad.
We were so proud of him, and we were so happy for him that he had realized his goals and was now in the big time and playing at the highest level.
But that didn't last long. Conrad suffered a knee injury in 2013, which kept him on injured reserve and practice squads the next 2 seasons. He rehabbed diligently, but NFL teams weren't convinced he could still play. Mary Ruhland was.
He was in the best shape of his life. He wasn't done yet.
In the spring of 2016, Conrad was back in California, where he'd often land in between contracts. He had taken business courses and was considering a career in real estate. Conrad was beginning to think about life beyond football. One day, as Mary made dinner, Conrad filled out his driver's license renewal form.
And he says, "Mom, do you think I should be an organ donor?" And I said, "Honey, that's completely your decision." And so he says, "Mom, are you one?" And I said, "Yes, I've always been one." And he says, "You know what? I'm going to do it." I just remember thinking at that time, gosh, I hope it never comes to something like that.
Conrad continued to train at a local gym while waiting for an opportunity with an NFL team. 2 days after Thanksgiving, he called home.
Conrad said that he had had a headache that developed. He had lifted some weights a little bit, nothing real strenuous, and then got on the treadmill. And after a minute or so on the treadmill, he felt like a little click in his head, and he felt the pain behind his left eye. As I'm a physician, I have a little bit of understanding about that. I was just hoping the whole time that wasn't an aneurysm. By the time we got to the hospital, they had already made the diagnosis. It was an aneurysm, and it was a bad one in a bad place. So we knew it was going to be a real tough situation.
Conrad was admitted to UCLA Medical Center. Mary stayed with him. The next day, when she was in the hospital cafeteria getting coffee to ease Conrad's persistent headache, she texted him an encouraging message. He texted back, saying, "I'm about to kick this thing's butt with the help of God. He had something big in store for me." Moments after sending that text, Conrad told a nurse that his headache had suddenly gotten much worse.
And then Conrad's aneurysm burst, and they did the 17-hour surgery to try to save his life.
He'd never again regain consciousness. On December 12, 2016, Conrad Ruhland was declared brain dead at the age of 29.
But at least we got the 4 days before it burst to tell him how much we loved him and how proud we were.
As the Ruhland's terrible drama played out, a more hopeful one was unfolding. Doctors kept Conrad's body on life support, and the call had gone out to the recipients at the top of the organ transplant list.
We had gone to San Diego for a doctor's appointment.
That's Rod Carew. He had suffered a massive heart attack in 2015. He needed a new heart.
And my wife was driving.
That would be Rhonda Carew.
So on the way back, we received a phone call, and she jumped at it and started to talk to someone, and they'd found me a heart.
I was shaking so badly, and it was like, okay, here it is. This is it. Here we go. And we had a list of people to either text or call, telling them that we were on our way, that we had received the call. And a couple of people texted back and asked the question, "Do you think it's Conrad Rulin. I didn't know why I was being asked that question.
Rhonda knew the name. The Rulins lived nearby, and the Carews knew Conrad was a pro football player. But she was too worried about her husband's health to give that too much thought. Rod's heart transplant was a success. Actually, his transplants were a success. He got a kidney, too. But he and Rhonda wondered from whom the organs had come. Mary Ruland had wanted to know to whom Conrad's organs had gone. She wanted to meet the recipient. Representatives of the Organ Donation Network told her that the protocol was that they'd have to wait at least a year.
I said, I don't care. Whoever gets his heart, we would like to meet them. And then the next thing I said was, and whoever gets his heart better deserve it, because it's a good one.
Conrad's funeral was held on December 23rd, 2016.
Countless people were coming up to me and saying, Mary, do you think it went to Rod Carew? And I'm looking at them like they suddenly grew a third eye or something. I'm like, what are you talking about? So, you know, the next day I was at home and I started looking on the internet and I saw the whole story of how it unfolded with Rod Carew. And I got to the part where it says the Heart of 29.
The Heart of 29 is Rod and Rhonda Carew's campaign to raise awareness about heart disease prevention. 29 was Rod's jersey number for his entire Major League career. Conrad died at age 29.
I'm like, this is not just a coincidence.
Meanwhile, the Carews discovered that Conrad Ruland had a blood type that was compatible with Rod's.
I mean, it was amazing. It all checked out, and the blood typing was the last item. Now we just need a confirmation that we were right.
Mary got Rhonda's number from a mutual friend, and against the recommendation of the organ donation agency, she called her.
And I think I said something to the effect of, hello, this is Mary Ruland, and I think your husband has my son's heart and left kidney.
They talked about blood type and all the amazing factors that helped make the match, but they still wanted confirmation.
And so I called the donor company and I said, hey, listen, you know, it's all over the internet, it's everywhere. I said, I need to know, did my son's heart and left kidney go to Rod Carew? And the lady kind of just paused for what seemed like an eternity, but it was probably just a second or so. And she said, yes, it did.
As far as anyone can tell, this was the first time a pro athlete donated a heart to another pro athlete. The families decided to meet in March of 2017. The Carews drove from their nearby home to the Rulins. Rod was nervous, but that didn't last long.
When we pulled up to the house, you know, Mary came out and gave me a big hug and gave Rhonda a big hug. And it was a great feeling for me because when Mary leaned over to put her head on my chest, I had to hold it back because I thought I was going to cry at that moment. So I held back and waited until she could hear Conrad's heart.
While Conrad had been in a coma after his 17-hour surgery, Mary had spent several days with her ear to his chest, listening to his beating heart. It had been 3 months since she had done that.
I had it memorized. I knew that sound. It was a Ferrari beating in that chest, and that just thrilled me. I was hoping that I would get to hear that heartbeat again.
Oh, boy, and he's beating. So now we're one, we're brothers, and we're going to do great work by spreading the words about donors and getting more people to listen to us, and hopefully they do.
We call ourselves the Carulans now. You know, we've got a picture of Conrad with our family photos. We spend a lot of time with them. And we, of course, we only live 12 miles apart, too, which is wonderful. They can listen to Conrad's heart anytime they choose.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Since this story aired last fall, Rod and Rhonda Carew became grandparents for the first time. An assist can be mundane or flashy, but it always makes the game better. The same is true with our podcast. You can dish out an assist by leaving a review of Only a Game at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you hear the show. Go ahead, get creative. What about a no-look review or a behind-the-back review? Whatever you write will help others find our show, and it'll prove you're not a ball hog. Ball hogs are the worst. The year was 2006. The setting, Los Angeles, California. The occasion was the beginning of the college basketball season and the opening of USC's brand new basketball court. Los Angeles Times columnist Bill Plaschke wrote about an assist that almost went unnoticed, and we present that story now as a double play. That's what we call our occasional series that turns newspaper columns into radio dramas.
The name is in giant cardinal letters, striped across two sides of the basketball court, the signature on USC's signature arena. It will be stepped upon by generations of Trojans basketball players. It will be seen by millions of Galen Center fans. Yet it is cloaked in mystery. Jim Sterkel Court.
"Are you sure?"
asks his wife, Joanne Sterkel.
"His name is on what?"
"It's on the hardwood, scripted there forever. Officially scuffed for the first time on November 16, 2006, when the Trojans opened the season against South Carolina. It honors a former Trojan who played only two seasons in the mid-1950s. He never averaged more than 10 points a game. His teams never won more than 16 games. He never graduated." Jim Sterkel Court.
"You're kidding me,"
asks his daughter, Jill.
"Are you sure you have the right man?"
He spent a lifetime working as a Johnson Wax salesman. He died of cancer in 1997. He left behind a wife of 38 years and three children and a modest Hacienda Heights home. He wasn't a Trojans donor. He never had Trojan season tickets. And if he had any Trojan memories, he kept them to himself. Jim Sterkel Court.
"I have no idea who put his name on there,"
says his wife.
"And I have no idea why."
A most amazing story in the City of Stars, a sports centerpiece decorated in average, laced in ordinary, painted in a nobody. Or was he? This tale, like many Hollywood tales, starts quietly in the suburbs in adolescence. Two boys meet at Mark Keppel High in Alhambra. One likes to play sports, the other likes to watch sports. And together they become as one, chasing fun and fear and dreams. They attend separate junior colleges but remain close. When they both enroll in USC in the fall of 1955, they become roommates. One is a 6'7", 230-pound center named Jim Sterkel. The other, for reasons you will understand later, is Anonymous. Anonymous was the businessman. Sterkel was the jock. And it was through sports that Anonymous best understood his friend.
"Jim came home from a game at USF one time with two black eyes,"
Anonymous said.
"It took him a while to admit that he had just taken two shots and that Bill Russell had blocked both of them right back in his face."
It was then that Anonymous realized Sterkel's honesty and lack of ego, something his teammates already knew. After scoring all of 9 baskets in his junior year, Sterkel was voted the team's most improved player in his senior year, averaging 9.6 points and 8.6 rebounds.
"He was never a great player, no,"
said Anonymous.
"But he was the kind that kept showing up."
After their senior years, the roommates set upon vastly different courses of life, but never strayed too far. Anonymous became a business tycoon, while Sterkel became a suburban salesman and church leader. Yet they still met for family dinners, fishing trips, and pep talks on the phone. Sterkel was the kind of guy who didn't smoke, didn't swear, and would lead his church in services and on its basketball courts. He was the kind of guy neighbors phoned if they needed a television fixed or pipe unclogged. Giant and bespectacled and always smiling, he was the kind of guy who hugged everyone. Anonymous was the kind of guy who, while leading a faster-paced life, gained strength from Sterkel's daily consistency.
"It's hard to find friends who last a lifetime,"
Anonymous recalled.
"For me, Jim was that guy.
When Sterkel retired from Johnson Wax, Anonymous hired him for a job at his company. When Sterkel first noticed a lump in his testicles, he told Anonymous, who immediately drove him to the doctor for the beginning of his long and fatal relationship with cancer. While Sterkel was dying, Anonymous's young son also contracted cancer. Sterkel wrote Anonymous a poem, sealed it, and ordered it only to be read if Anonymous's son died. Less than 2 years after Sterkel's death, Anonymous's son died of leukemia. He unsealed and read the poem. He said he still feels its imprint today.
I'll never forget that he took the time out of his own life during his final days to do this for me, to try to inspire my life, even when he was losing his own life,
Anonymous said. It was this inspiration that Anonymous remembered when he was approached by USC with an offer to make a donation to put his name on the new court. He could have given the school his son's name. Most people would have given their own name. Instead, he wrote a check for about $5 million and gave the name of Jim Sterkel.
Some people don't deserve to be forgotten,
Anonymous said.
Maybe this will keep him around a little longer.
Anonymous had only one request, that the donation be forever nameless, so USC refused to provide me with his name. Even once I figured it out, Anonymous did not answer repeated interview requests for this story, until he was finally promised that it would not include his name.
The joy I have in remembering Jim would be significantly reduced if people knew who I was,
he said. When he finally agreed to the interview, my first question had been rolling around in my gut for a week. So what exactly did Jim Sterkel do for you to warrant this incredible honor, I asked. Did he give you a kidney? Did he pull you out of a burning car? Anonymous sighed.
He did much more than that,
he said.
He was my friend.
That's Alex Ashlock, Walter Dixon, Amory Sievertson, and Karen Miller Metzen reading Bill Plaschke's Los Angeles Times column, Floored. The friendship between the U.S. and Canada doesn't go back as far as you might think.
The Speaker of the House, the Paul Ryan of his day, actively advocates for the annexation of Canada. That's his whole point.
Just ahead, how an assist from the U.S. led to a turning point in U.S.-Canadian relations and a historic hockey program. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Karen Given.
It's Michigan! And the Wolverines are the national champions!
What if I told you that the most successful college hockey program in U.S. history owes its existence to a Canadian who grew up hating the United States, to an unsolicited act of kindness from an entire city, and to one of the largest explosions in history?
Incredibly, it is fair to say that.
That's John Bacon, who's researched the founding of the University of Michigan hockey program. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler with the story.
Picture the House chamber at the U.S. Capitol. It's 1911, and the Speaker of the House, a guy named Champ Clark, takes the floor and says,
I look forward to the time when the American flag will fly over every square foot of British North America up to the North Pole.
The Speaker of the House, the Paul Ryan of his day, actively advocates for the annexation of Canada. That's his whole point.
That's John Bacon again.
He received loud cheers and a great write-up in the Washington Post. So that's how unfriendly we were as late as 1911.
Anyways, north of the border, lots of people were not too fond of the U.S. Joseph Bars, the guy at the center of this story, was 19 years old in 1911, and he had basically been born to hate the United States. It was in his blood. His ancestors had once lived in Massachusetts, but fled to Nova Scotia.
They were loyal to the crown and not to the rebels, the revolutionaries, of course.
When the Revolutionary War started, Barr's great-great-grandfather fought on the British side. But Barr's was named after his great-grandfather, who was even more fearsome.
He captures, burns, or sinks more than 60 American ships during the War of 1812, so much so that he becomes the most wanted man in America. And that is our hero's great-grandfather.
Joseph Bars grew up in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. He was just 5'8", but he was strong. He starred on the hockey team at Acadia University. Not long after graduation, he found a personal reason to hate the United States. In 1915, he gave up a comfortable job in Montreal to join the Canadian Army in the trenches of World War I. He was angry that the United States wasn't yet sending troops. Soon he had bigger problems. At the Battle of Mont Sorel in 1916, a German trench mortar nearly killed him. Bars was in a body cast for 6 months, then returned to Wolfville, about an hour from Halifax, to recuperate. The man who'd once been strong enough to do a lap around the rink on unlaced ice skates now struggled to move his left foot.
He comes back and he's kind of a lost soul, essentially. He does not want to go back to Montreal and be a businessman. He does not want to take over his dad's grocery store, which his dad thought he would. So he's lost, looking for a sense of purpose, and he finds it by accident.
In November 1917, Russia dropped out of the war. This meant the Germans could focus on the Western Front, and that made the Allies very nervous. They decided they needed more firepower. A French freighter called the Mont Blanc went to New York to stock up on airplane fuel and explosives. Then it headed north to meet a convoy in Halifax that would then leave for Europe. The Mont Blanc was packed with 6 million pounds of TNT and another explosive called picric acid.
That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty, and they're so nervous about it that they cover their boots with canvas covers to make sure they don't spark on deck. You're not allowed to have matches on your person anywhere near the ship, and in a smoking era, that's a four-day sacrifice these French guys are not used to. So that's how terrified they are of this thing blowing up, and it crawls up the coast to Halifax.
German U-boats had already sunk 3,000 Allied ships, so the Mont Blanc crew was itching to get into Halifax Harbor.
These guys are terrified of getting blown up. Another ship, the Emo, a Norwegian supply ship, it's already a day late and wants to get to New York to load up with various relief supplies. They have no idea what Mont Blanc has got on it. Only like 5 guys in the harbor who aren't on the ship know about this. Emo is in a hurry that morning, and it keeps on passing ships on the left. That is against nautical convention.
Both the Mont Blanc and the Emo reached the narrows of the Halifax Harbor at the same time, heading right at each other.
And Mont Blanc thinks this guy is crazy and has one blast on the horn, which means I'm in the right place, you need to move. And Emo comes back with 2 blasts, saying, screw you, I'm going this way. Finally, at the last second, Mont Blanc realizes this guy's crazy, so it bails to the left, to the middle of the harbor, just as Emo does the same thing.
They collided. It wasn't a big collision, but it was enough to knock over barrels of airplane fuel on the Mont Blanc.
And the stuff ignites, and the crew knows they're about to blow up. So they hop in their rowboats and go the other way away from Halifax, crucially. Instead of warning anybody, they go to the woods of Dartmouth and they run into the woods as far as they can.
The ghost ship, now on fire, continued toward Pier 6 in Halifax Harbor. On land, one of the guys who knew what the Mont Blanc was carrying started hollering that the ship was going to blow and everyone needed to run. A train dispatcher named Vincent Coleman heard the message and started to run for his life.
And then he stops because he remembers that the number 10 train from New Brunswick is coming in 5 minutes. It's going to park right in front of Pier 6. And if it does, everyone's going to die. So he runs back to the telegram office and starts furiously clacking off these messages to other train stations saying the following. Hold up the train. Ammunition ship afire in harbor, making for Pier 6 and will explode. Guess this will be my last message. Goodbye, boys. And those are his last words.
At 9:04 in the morning, the Mont Blanc exploded.
This is a miniature atomic bomb. Human beings were flown 0.5 mile in all directions. In that split second, 25,000 people are homeless, half the city is gone, 9,000 are wounded, and 2,000 are dead.
For the next 3.5 hours, all the telegraph lines in Halifax were down. But thanks to that final message from Vincent Coleman, word started to spread. And that's how Joseph Bars and the people in Wolfville got the news.
A doctor friend of his says, you know first aid, you gotta come and help me.
Bars, still walking with a cane, boarded the next train for Halifax and ended up at Camp Hill Hospital. The hospital was packed. There were so many people in need of help that doctors ran out of anesthesia. They kept operating. For the next 14 straight hours, Bars dressed wounds, set fractures, and even helped with surgeries, something he'd never done before. Meanwhile, Vincent Coleman's message had also gotten to Boston. The Massachusetts governor called an emergency meeting and, without waiting to hear back from anyone in Halifax, decided to send a train filled with doctors, nurses, and medical supplies. Meanwhile, Bars kept working in the hospital. After about 3 days, he was finally relieved by the doctors from Boston. One Nova Scotia historian wrote, "Substantial help was on the way from Toronto and Montreal, but the first and most valuable assistance came from that ancient foe beyond the Bay of Fundy."
And that is when the U.S. and Canadian relationship starts to change, and very dramatically. And Bars himself, very anti-American for a lot of reasons, he says, "I will never be able to say enough about the wonderful help the states have sent. The response was so spontaneous and everything done even before it was asked for. It brought tears to all our eyes. You know, we've always been a trifle contemptuous of the United States, but never again. They can have anything I've got, and I don't think I feel any differently from anyone else down here either."
On the train ride back to Wolfville, Bars, the man who'd been so lost, realized what he wanted to do with his life. He would become a doctor. And instead of going to a Canadian university, Bars enrolled at the University of Michigan. There, he started to skate at Michigan's Coliseum. This was the steel and concrete three-walled building that housed the hockey rink. Bars slowly made his way around the ice, trying to regain control of his foot. By 1922, he was healthy enough to referee the club hockey team's games.
And finally, he walks down to the athletic director's office, Fielding Yost, who built the big house in Ann Arbor, one of the most legendary coaches out there. And Bars says, "You need a hockey program." Yost is from West Virginia and born in 1871, the son of a Confederate soldier. So this guy does not know a damn thing about hockey, rest assured. But he saw something in Bars that he must have liked. And Fielding Yost says, "Only if you're the first coach." And he gives them the full rein and the funding for it. So that is how the University of Michigan got hockey.
For the next 5 years, Bars shuttled between his med school classes and the hockey rink. He coached Michigan to 2 league titles. The team was popular, and that early success mattered. When the Great Depression hit, many schools in the Midwest dropped their hockey programs, but not Michigan. The Wolverines have since gone on to win 9 national championships, more than any other program in the country. Meanwhile, Boston and Halifax have stayed connected. Every year, Nova Scotia sends a 50-foot, 2-ton Christmas tree to Boston as thanks for the city's help after the explosion.
3, 2, 1, light the tree!
As for Joseph Bars, after finishing medical school, he became the chief of surgery at a veterans hospital in Chicago, then opened his own practice. Oh, and one last thing. Joseph Bars, great-grandson of the guy who sank all those American ships, wound up marrying a woman from Battle Creek, Michigan. He became an American citizen.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. For much more on the life of Joseph Bars and the events of December 6, 1917, check out John Bacon's book, The Great Halifax Explosion. We've heard stories of life-changing, life-saving assists in this week's show, but we're going to end with one that might not seem like such a big deal, unless you're WNBA fan Maya Goldberg-Safer. Here's Maya.
It's October in Chicago. My friend Sarah and I step out of her apartment and into her twinkling, bar-lined neighborhood with purpose. "If they can't do it, we'll have to leave," I say. "We have no other choice." Sarah nods. "Tonight, we have one goal. To get a drink at a sports bar while watching the do-or-die Chicago Sky playoff game." "That's right. We want to watch women's basketball. At a bar. In public." "I mean, they'll probably have it on, right?" Sarah says. "Oh, Sarah. This is my 20th year watching the WNBA. Ever since the league started in 1997, when I was 7, and playing ball at every recess. I had no idea how quickly I'd get fed up with myself in the basketball gym, or that I'd tearfully quit my elite AAU team suddenly at age 13. And I didn't know how fascinated I'd become with the players who kept playing, women whose bodies move with breathtaking strength, often discarding notions of femininity like an extra sweat towel. These days, I'm so taken with WNBA professionals that sometimes I make the trek alone to Rosemont, the Chicago suburb where the Sky play home games, to watch them compete, across from a restaurant equipment warehouse in a stadium pockmarked with fans. Now I'm dragging Sarah along with me. We duck into a cavernous sports bar. Sarah asks the bartender, "Excuse me, would you mind changing one of these to ESPN2? "What's on ESPN2? He says. "It's the Chicago Sky playoff game," and the bartender stares back, then gets his act together. "I'm sorry, we have trivia tonight, actually, and we need to have the Blackhawks on this TV and this one, and this one." He points to all the TVs in the bar. Then he shrugs, almost generously. "It's just that we just can't." Sarah and I leave quickly. The game has already started. "What about over there?" She points to the next sports bar, a little more excited now. This has become a quest. We approach the High Dive, a bar known for its chicken wing special. I really hope this one works out. And I declare to the bouncer, "So, we want to watch the WNBA. Would you guys put it on?" "Oh, I'm down with that. Definitely down with that," says the bouncer guy, who's not a bouncer at all. He's an angel. "But they just want to watch hockey here. You gotta ask the bartender." We have found an ally. Sure enough, inside there are a bunch of dudes scattered around the bar, the Blackhawks preseason game shining on all four television monitors. Then we notice. It's the greatest sight we've witnessed all night. The bartender. She's a woman. "Hey, could we, do you think ESPN2, any of the, yeah, over there? Yes!" Sarah and I launch at the bar all at once. And just 10 minutes later, I forgive her, the remote was acting really funky. Voila! We're watching Chicago's very own professional women's basketball team battling to keep their playoff run alive.
If Chicago is able to come back and win this game, we will see you Thursday night in Los Angeles.
And yes, the hockey-watching men scoff and smirk. And yes, I already know the Sky will get pummeled by the Los Angeles Sparks. And yes, these players still earn a relatively measly salary decades behind the earnings of the NBA. Right now, I don't care. Because we're drinking cheap beer and eating an excellent chicken wing special at just another sports bar. All while watching women, most of them black and many of them queer, compete on a nationally overrated, I mean broadcast, sports network. As soon as the server comes to take our order, we offer to buy her a shot. She agrees. "To women," we toast. It is a small, bright victory.
That's Maya Goldberg-Safer. That story was from 2016, and a version of it first appeared on The Hairpin. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.